At this time, I'm going to ask Sue to come up and introduce our spiritual speaker.
Let's go. Good morning, everybody.
We'll start a video.
I'm so excited that I got to participate in the selection of our spiritual speaker. Buckle up, you're in for a treat. So in a second, I want to ask all of you to join me in welcoming Rosemary. I am going to read some of this because there's a lot. There's a lot to this lady. So her journey, it began in January of 1986 in New York City. Immersed in the heart of the program from the start, Rosemary was guided by seasoned members and embraced service with enthusiasm. She is attending meetings, workshops, retreats, conferences that shaped her early recovery. Anyone know the 6 degrees from Jason Bateman game? Right? With Bacon, what did I say? Yeah, Kevin. As long as you knew what I meant. Well, we can do 6 degrees with Rosemary. I'm telling you, she's connected to everybody. So later in Flagstaff, Arizona, she continued her commitment to service, including years as the Al-Anon chair for the Flagstaff Roundup. While she humbly admits that memory isn't her strong suit, what she does recall is following her sponsor's guidance, showing up, and staying close to the wisdom of the old timers. One thing that has never faded, Rosemary never turns down an opportunity to talk about God. Her spiritual connection and willingness to share it have been a steady light throughout her journey. Rosemary brings with her decades of experience, a deep spiritual connection to the program, and a heartfelt message rooted in the timeless of principles of Al-Anon. She reminds us that it was a great time. It is a great time to be in Al-Anon, and it's a great time to be in Al-Anon now. So let's do it. Welcome, Rosemary.
Wow, I want you to speak at my funeral. That was impressive. I was like getting all teary-eyed. My name is Rosemary Derry, and I am a very grateful member of the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon Family Groups. And I am very grateful to be here this morning, and I am very excited to talk about spiritual matters, which I will refer to as God. And as I tell the girls that I work with, he, she, tree, don't matter to me, whatever you want to call it, as long as it's not you, it's not me, and we'll talk about it this morning. And I just want to thank all of you so much for your service, and it's just been such an honor to be invited here, but also just to hear what goes on here, and the behind the scenes work that goes on that most people sitting in meetings have no idea what happens. But it's the people that are sitting in the meetings and the new people that are coming in, which is why we do what we do. The work that we do behind the scenes. So thank you for your service for everybody that came out. So I'm just gonna, I don't have any more to add. That was pretty much it. I'm from New York City. When I got down here to Richmond, I had an old timer say, "Oh, you're a Yankee." And I said, yeah, I'm a Yankee. And they said, "You know the difference between a Yankee and a damn Yankee?" And I said, "No." And they said, "A Yankee is somebody who comes down from the North and visits, and a damn Yankee is somebody who comes down from the North and stays." So as of, I think, March, I got my Virginia driver's license, and I am officially a resident of Richmond, Virginia. And that is a pretty circuitous route that I took to get here. As I said, I came in January of 86, and I'll just tell you a little bit about how I got here. So I'm an artist, self-employed for about 48 years now, maybe. And my specialty is working with World War II veterans. And I've done military aviation art for all those years. And a lot of it was painting leather jackets and painting airplanes and doing a lot of work and all of the patches and insignia you see. And then Top Gun, when that came out, that was a lot of the work that I did. And so anyway, I've been doing that for a long time, working with veterans. And I moved around a lot because I could just do whatever I did and just send it back to the companies that I was doing work for. And I lived in a lot of places. So I grew up in New York. I went to college in New York City. I went to art school. And the day after I graduated, I like to tell people I, I was on the stage at Lincoln Center, which I was. I walked across it to get my diploma and then right off. But I was on the stage at Lincoln Center. And so I moved out to, let's see, where did I go? I moved down to the Virgin Islands. I lived in St. John for a few years. And then I lived out in San Francisco for a few years. And then I came back to New York and I was on my way to London. And I met my soon to be husband at a bar. Surprise, surprise. But he actually owned the restaurant that was attached to the bar. And I was up there with a bunch of my brothers and I was getting ready to leave town. And I went there to, you know, watch a football game or something. I hate football. I'm sure I was there just to hang out because one of the guys was cute that my brother was with. And, you know, I have seven brothers and a sister. I'm a Irish Catholic from New York City. So I come by this stuff, honestly. I'm a member of Al-Anon just by that alone. And anyway, so I met a guy there. He was wearing a leather jacket and he had the insignia, but it was an original World War II jacket. And we started talking and he had just gotten out of treatment, which I didn't really know what that meant. And he said that he, you know, was an alcoholic and he was sober. Didn't really know what that meant either. And I think that was in October and we were married in June. So it didn't take long for me to, you know, I wasn't really looking to get married, but I had grown up like pre-women's lib, where it was the idea that, you know, of course someday you'll get married and you'll let a man take care of you and you'll keep a house and have kids. And it was like, that was never something that I wanted, but I thought that's what I was supposed to do. So I really tried hard to move in that direction. And he seemed to work well. My mother used to say that he was like the eighth boy that she never had. And he fit right in. He was from my home neighborhood. And so anyway, we got married and we stayed in New York for a little bit. And then we ended up moving out to Flagstaff, Arizona. And the way I found Al-Anon was we met in October. And in December, on New Year's Eve, we were in Mammoth, California. We went out to visit his sister and brother-in-law. And he went to a meeting and it was an open AA meeting. And I went with him and they asked me to read something. It was a small meeting. And they asked me to read something, I don't know, maybe the traditions or something. And I started to read it and I just got all choked up and I was so grateful because he was gonna get help because he was so sick and he needed this so bad and I was so happy. And meanwhile, on the ride from the airport up to their house, I was looking at these billboards, you know, do you have a problem with drugs? Do you have a problem with cocaine? Do you have a problem with drinking? I'm copying the numbers down. I'm thinking I'm gonna get these numbers for him so that he can get to meetings while we're out here visiting. And it just never occurred to me that this had anything to do with me. I was just a, you know, a support system for him. And I went to the meeting and I was crying and so grateful that he was going to get help. And after the meeting, somebody said to me, have you ever heard of Al-Anon? And I said, no, I don't know what that is. And they said, yeah, you might want to check that out when you get home. So the first meeting I went to was January 5th of 1986, and it was in my grammar school first grade classroom. And the beginners meeting that they took the beginners out and then they brought us over into the nurse's office, which I was familiar with that office also. And that was where we were taught a little bit about Al-Anon before we went into the regular meeting. And that was my first meeting and I have not found it necessary to leave Al-Anon ever since then for various reasons. One of them was because I was looking for that piece of paper that was gonna show me how to keep him sober. Where is that paper? I'm still looking for it. And I was looking for that piece of paper. And then I was living in a neighborhood where I knew a lot of the, I got to know a lot of the people and I would see them up at the boulevard or in the stores. And I would go because I didn't want to tell you that I was going to be there and then not be there. You know, I was going for various reasons. And one day it occurred to me that I started to realize that I was going because I wanted to go, like I wanted to be there. And I didn't notice that it was really working on me, but I was getting something. I couldn't really put my finger on it. But it was early on that I had to ask my sponsor, you know, am I okay? Is this working? I couldn't see it. And I kind of depended on my sponsor to be able to say, you know, doing a good job, keep going. Yes. And, you know, taking me through the steps and getting into service early on. They tricked me into that. And as we all do, you know, I was voluntold. And in New York at the time, it was great because I got to go to a few assemblies and luncheons. I got to meet Lois, which was really a great gift. Although at the time, honestly, I didn't really know the impact of what that meant, you know, really, especially years later, obviously. But I came in with a lot of the old timers, the black belts in New York City, one of the original New York City groups. And just like anything, I think I'd do the same thing with my grandparents. You know, I wish they were still here so I could ask them questions, because I didn't know then to ask them questions. But now I can appreciate the fact that I was even in their presence and did learn from them by being in meetings with them. And I am looking forward to hopefully celebrating 40 years January 5th. And that's a big deal for me.
Yeah.
You know, really what the big deal for me was when I hit a year, because when I hit a year, I realized, wow, this is the first thing I have ever done really just for me. Because originally I came for him, and then I came because of the people that were in the meetings, and I didn't want to, you know, let them down, I thought, somehow. And eventually I was coming because I wanted to come, and I was coming because I realized, yes, it is doing something for me, and I am learning from it. And so I keep coming back because I love it more now than I did in all of those years. It just keeps getting better. And if it didn't, why would I keep coming? I mean, if I'm not still growing, why would I keep coming back? You know, I have better things to do on a Monday night, on a Tuesday night, on a Thursday night, you know, whenever it is that I go to these meetings. I love this program. And mostly what I love about it is when there's a newcomer sitting in our meeting, and I'm watching her, and she looks devastated, and she has no idea why she's sitting there, and she has no idea what's going on, but she's sitting there. And I just think, and people feel so bad when she tells her story, and people go, oh my gosh, oh, that's so horrible, that's so terrible. And I go, I think this is great. I'm so happy she is here, because we have a solution. We have an answer for her if she wants it. And that is so exciting to me. So you come, bring it on. Tell me the worst of the worst of the worst stories. Come on, bring it on. I am so excited for you. If you just keep coming back and you keep doing what we did, what I did, that there is a solution. And anything that you hold up to the light of those 12 steps, there's a solution. That's some great, great news. People don't know that. But in those meetings, when you hear those newcomers and those one-on-one stories, man, this stuff gets real. Because in this kind of a setting, it's sort of like just a, you know, kind of a theory, you know, it's out there. We're talking about it. We're talking about the groups. We're talking about the business of Al-Anon, which is really important. But sitting with those newcomers one-on-one, that's why we do what we do. I've had the opportunity to travel a lot, and I go to meetings wherever I go. I tell people all the time, do not miss that chance to go to meetings when you're out of town. People go on vacation and they take a vacation from Al-Anon, and it's, you're missing out. Some of the best meetings I've been to are on the road and meeting people, and you walk in, you're, oh, I don't really know anybody, until you sit down and people start talking, and they go, oh, I know you. I know you. You have a different face and a different name, but I know you, because you're just like me. God help you if you're just like me. But so I lived in Flagstaff for years. I have a son who is 32 now. And I lived in different parts of Arizona, and then I moved back here, and I lived in Cape May for years while my son went to college in DC. And then he graduated in May of 2016. And in December of 2016, I got this voice in my head that's not the committee. It's another voice. It's a much clearer voice that said, it's time to go. And I just thought, go where? And it was, I looked around and I thought, what am I going to do with all my stuff? And just like that, I lost my attachment to everything that was in that house. And I knew that it was time to go. And I got rid of everything that I owned. I gave it away. I didn't really sell much. I just mostly gave it away. And I gave up my house that I was living in Cape May, New Jersey for years. And I hit the road. And I have been a nomad pretty much ever since. That'll be almost 9 years in December. And I'll go places and I'll be there for a little while, and I can work wherever I am. So it's really kind of the beautiful part of it. And I'd go someplace and I'd be there for 9 months. Sometimes I'd stay for a year, but mostly it's just 3 months. Sometimes it's a few weeks. And I went to go visit a lot of the people that I had worked with, a lot of the vets. Of course, now most of them are all gone. In fact, all of the ones that I knew were gone. But I got to go travel and see some of them and their families. And then I got to see my family that I hadn't seen for a long time. Distant relatives that I hadn't gotten to visit, because I have such a big family. I would take my son and we would go to visit my family and his dad's family. And so when I traveled, I wanted to visit, but I also still had to work. And so I ended up getting being a part of this website that is out of the UK, and it's for house sitting. And it's a sharing thing. So you don't pay me and I don't pay you, but I pay to be a part of it. You pay to be a part of it. I get vetted. I get reviewed. But I can go anywhere in the world and I can stay for as long as I want. Different houses you use it kind of like an Airbnb. And so that's how I've been able to travel around a lot. And that's how I got to Richmond. And this is when my car broke down. So I ended up being here for a little while, and I had been looking for a place to stop because I had done everything that I had wanted to do on the road, and I was looking for a place to live, and I didn't want to go back to any of the places that I had lived. And God had heard me when I had written in my journal just a few days before that I was looking for a place to stop. I was looking for a home group. I was looking for a group of women that were dedicated to this program. I was looking for a group of women that were faithful to their higher power, and it showed, and they were active in their faith and in their program. And I thought, and it might be nice to meet somebody, like a partner or something. I hadn't had a relationship, a boyfriend, so to speak, since 2007, really. And I hadn't really stopped. I wasn't really interested. And I turned the page, and then I thought, never mind, forget that part. I don't want that part. You know, I just want to keep going. And my car broke down here, and I did meet somebody here. And I ended up leaving again for a few months, and we talked on the phone for 2 months. And then I ended up coming back because I thought, if you're going to date somebody, it would probably be helpful to live in the same state. So I came back, and I have been living here, renting month to month in Richmond. And I still do a lot of traveling, and that's kind of winding down now because I've planned it that way. And I'm going to get my own place starting in December and call Richmond home, which is really wonderful for me. Not so much for some of the guys that are in the meetings with me. They're like, oh, we thought she'd keep going. But so that's sort of a little bit of my journey and how I move around a lot and how I get to go to a lot of meetings. And so consequently, I haven't done a lot of service work at this level, except when I first came in New York, because I haven't been anywhere for very long. But I appreciate everything that you've done. My sponsor has gone all the way up and has done all of that service work, and a lot of the people that she sponsors. And so I've had the same sponsor that was self-appointed, as a matter of fact. I was in Flagstaff, and I was running the Al-Anon portion of the Flagstaff Roundup, and I had gotten this sponsor, I had gotten the speaker, Al-Anon speaker, to be a part of this AA convention, and I wanted someone who was like AA friendly, you know, because a lot of the times it was, especially back then, it was us and them, and AAs and Al-Anons did not interact. And so I got this speaker that came to visit, and she was from North Little Rock, and she came out to speak for me and for us. And after she spent the weekend with me before she left, she's like, I'm going to be your sponsor. She said, you need somebody who can, you know, tell you what to do. And I said, yeah, I do. Good luck with that, by the way. And anyway, she has been my sponsor for 35 years now. And so that doesn't mean what I would thought it would have meant. You know, I'm not married to the sponsor. If I needed to get another sponsor tomorrow, I would get another sponsor. I'm really, really, this is a really big deal to me to talk about sponsorship. I'm not here to rack up the years. I'm not here to impress anybody to tell you, well, I've been with the same person, you know, and it's been fresh all the time. And I am called on the carpet all the time by her. And that's what I need. And sometimes I'll call her up and I'll say, I know what you're going to say, but I still need to hear you say it. And then tell me why you're going to say it, because I don't really understand it, but I need you to say it. And so what I want to say about that is that I tell people all the time, the people that are working with me, this is not a marriage. This is not this, you know, big, huge commitment where if it's not working for you, then it's not working. And if you're not active and you're not feeling connected and you're not feeling excited about the work that you're doing with a sponsor, then consider challenging the sponsor too about let's do something. Let's get into the books that I left on the table that I meant to bring up. I'm right. I have my memory is terrible, but I look who brings it up. The one who's selling them. Thank you. So I think it was Sue that asked me about what are my favorite pieces of literature. And I was saying my favorite, you know, piece of literature is that big workbook, and I can never remember the name of it, Paths to Recovery or Reaching for Something. I don't know what it is. And I don't remember what it is because one of my sponsees calls it the tree book. And that's what I've called it ever since. It's the tree book. And I think they heard me say Paths to Recovery, which is this book. And this is not the book I was talking about, but this is also the same thing because it's the tree book. It's the big green book that has the tree reaching for personal freedom. And the point is that that book has changed my recovery. It has, there it is. There it is back over there. It's the tree book. And it has taken my recovery to a new level because what happens is And just like this book too, is that I have worked the steps, I have worked the traditions, and I have worked the concepts. And I work the steps and the traditions and the concepts with the girls that I work with. And I work them with a lot of people, especially during COVID. You know, people had asked me to work with them. And so, you know, shame on me. I forgot who I was sponsoring and who I was just taking through all those concepts and steps and traditions during COVID, because, you know, there's nothing else to do. So, and they called me and I answered. So the point is that this book and that book, the steps were for me, the traditions were for my relationships, and the concepts are on the broader scale, which is a lot of what you guys are doing. But the personal stories and then the questions, it was just transformative, and it was exciting. Because when I first came in, you know, oh God, it's a step meeting. A lot of people wouldn't want to go, oh, tradition meeting, forget it. Nobody would be there. Concept meeting, didn't even ever hear of them. So now today, when I hear a step meeting or a tradition meeting or a concept meeting, you know, when we use this literature and we see how these translate into our personal lives, it is nothing short of exciting. I mean, this is really exciting to me. There is a line. Now, I grew up with the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. My sponsor is a Big Book person. Book too. And so I have learned a lot from that book. And one of the things, and the 12 and 12 also, because we didn't have much literature when she came in. I think, so if I have 40 years, she's got like 52. Her sponsor was Lou Bell, and she just died a couple of years ago with maybe 60 years. And at that time, Lou Bell, her husband was Joe from the Joe and Charlie and tape studies. And so we learned in the Big Book and the 12 and 12. And there's a line in the 12 and 12 and in step 12, and it talks about translating these steps into all areas of our lives. That is the magnificent reality of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon and Alateen. And it is this magnificent reality of what happens. Remarkable things happen when I start this journey. And so it starts with that first step about how I admit that I'm powerless. And you know, in Al-Anon, we talk about admitting that we're powerless over alcohol, over the alcoholic, over people, places, and things. You know, I start to realize like how powerless I really am, and that my life does become unmanageable. And it really, unbelievable to me, that it really had nothing to do with him. I really wanted to pin it on him, but I had just met him. And I really couldn't pin it on my parents. My parents didn't drink. Their parents drank, and all of their siblings drank. And in fact, a lot of them died from alcoholism. So I do come by it honestly, but I couldn't really, I'm looking around like, whose fault is this? And Al-Anon just gave me about four or five meetings, and he did this and they did that and they said that, and they would sit there and nod their head. And after about four or five meetings, they would say, okay, that's enough. Now we're going to talk about you, me. And yes, you. And what is your part in your experience? I don't have a part in my experience. It's their fault, you know. And they said, no, this is really, you know, really is about me. And it was pretty clear early on that it really was about me. I couldn't blame it on anybody. And so I was grateful in that regard that I was pretty much turned, you know, it turned inward pretty quickly to take a look at myself and have these steps applied to myself. So where am I powerless, and where am I unmanageable, and where am I insane? And then it comes to this lovely part of step three. And the insanity was, one of my favorite definitions was a desire to change the past or to know the future. You know, and my need to know is my need to control. And my need to control is because I want to play God. You know, I grew up with a God. I grew up with a religion. I grew up with the offering of a relationship with a higher power, but I wasn't interested because I already had a punishing father figure at home. I didn't really need another one, and I wasn't interested until I was desperate. And then I came to you guys, and I was trying to control this guy, and he was supposed to be doing these things. And so here's the thing. I remember it like it was yesterday. I really meant well. I really loved this guy. I wanted to help him. I really did. And I remember giving him 25 cents to call your sponsor when you were at work today. And, you know, do you need the car tonight? Are you going to a meeting? And I meant well. I wasn't trying to control him. I was trying to help him. But it did turn into control, all the way down to silly things like how he ate dinner, you know. And I said to him, why do you do that? He'd eat all of the potatoes and then all the meat and then all. And I would say, why don't you just go, why would I do this? Why don't you go around and try a little bit of this and a little bit of that? And, you know, and he would sit there with his fork, and he'd just be swinging his fork in the air, watching me, listening to me, you know. And he said, you want to know why I eat like this? And I said, yeah, why do you eat like that? And he goes, because it drove my mother crazy. You know, there's no reason And I, who am I to tell somebody else how to eat? But I thought I knew better. Like, if you ate like I ate, then I would be okay. If you did what I thought, if you did what I thought you should do, then I would be okay. And that was the point. Like, if everything out here would just line up so that I would be okay in here. And what Al-Anon introduced me to is the idea of, if you take care of in here, then out here doesn't have the power to move you around like it used to. And so that's what step three started to talk about, was that I, you know, made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God that I don't understand. I still don't understand. I figured if I could understand God, that God wouldn't be big enough to do everything that he needs to do. So I'm good with not understanding. And so I was willing and I was desperate. Gift of desperation. Somebody pointed that out. The acronym is G-O-D. I had that gift of desperation because I had nowhere else to turn. I didn't know what else to do. And so I came at this God thing in a different direction as opposed to just religion, which consequently, years later, I did return to my religion because there was a lot in it that was very helpful and familiar to me and soothing and wonderful. And I could take what I liked and leave the rest. And I'm not saying that I, you know, it's sort of the same thing here. You know, not everything here always resonates, but what does resonate really is very helpful. So made a decision. It's not a discussion for me, it's a decision. And a decision in step three is not for the rest of my life. It's not for the rest of the year. It's not for the rest of the month. It's not for the rest of the day. Sometimes that decision is just going to be for the next 5 minutes. I'm going to try to turn it over because I'm so obsessed with thinking, where is he? What's he doing? What's going on? What's going to happen? Okay, can I sit here for a minute? Can I sit here for 5 minutes? 5 minutes, I'm going to sit here and I'm making a decision to turn it over. And turning over my will and my life is just turning over my thoughts and my actions about any given person, place, or thing. You know, it's not any big deal person. What was it say? Made a decision to turn my will and my life. Well, what does that even mean? It's hard to understand that, especially when you're new. So it was about just my thoughts and my actions about anything. And can I switch my thoughts over from worrying about something or person, you know, the person that I'm obsessing over? And can I turn it over to the care of God? I'm not turning it over to God and I'm going to go sit on the couch and, you know, eat bonbons and watch TV. I'm going to turn it over to the care of God and then I'm going to do the work. And the work is the steps. I mean, that is this program, is the steps. And so when I'm doing that third step, I'm going to make a decision. I'm going to do something different. I'm going to get into that fourth step and I'm going to start working those columns. I learned to work the columns out of the big book. I was taught that you go from top to bottom, not side to side. I take that resentment inventory. If I go across and I name that resentment, and there's usually a couple of resentments for each name. And if I go across and I start talking about it and I start checking the boxes of what did it affect, my pride, my self-esteem, my, you know, relationships, my pocketbook, my serenity, by the time I get to that last column, like, I'm immersed in it again. I get bogged down. It's really hard to move through that. But if I take that first column and just write down all of the resentments that I have and all of the names, oh, that's fun. I got that. I mean, I've been thinking about these for a long time and I just go, I'm writing that list and I'm naming all those names. And then I go to the second column and I write down just a little bit about what each resentment is. I don't have to write a life story. This is how I work it. I don't have to write my life story because in the fifth step, when I get a chance to talk about them, I'm going to have all the time in the world to talk about them. And you're not going to need to prod me much to remember what it was, the resentment, because I've been carrying it around for a long time. So I don't need necessarily to write it down, but I need to just write down a little bit about what it was about and then go to the next column and then check what those things affected in my life and realize like how those resentments really do affect my life in so many different areas. And then I do the sick man prayer that's in the big book, talks about, you know, please remove that person out of this equation because they're spiritually sick, but then so am I too. So the last column is, where am I to blame? Like, that's the part I think is one of the greatest gifts of the 12 steps, is that particular column. Because if I can't see my part in my experience, then I'm not going to be able to change. I'm not going to be able to do anything. Because if I'm waiting for you or them or it to change, I'm going to be here for a long time. If I can change, then everything else around me starts to change, you know. And it talks about, you know, when I change the way I look at things, the things I look at change. And when I have invited God into this experience and asked for help, no human power can relieve me of this disease of alcoholism, how I've been affected. No human power can relieve me of my resentments, of my anger, of my fear, my worry. It's the ABCs in the big book. No human power can relieve me of my alcoholism. I'm a human power. I can't do it. I need help. And then it says, God could and would if he were sought. And I think that word sought becomes one of the most important words in that big book, which translates into our literature, because it doesn't say when I figured God out, when I found out who it was, when I, you know, understood it. It just says I start seeking. That's all I have to do. And it says God doesn't make hard terms. And God doesn't make hard terms. This is all about a relationship with a power greater than myself that could restore me to sanity. And the insanity is that I think that I know what's best for somebody else. I think that I know if you would just do what I think you should do, then I would be okay. It didn't ever occur to me that I was trying to, you know, control people or that it was a bad thing. I was just going along kind of blindly. But what happens when I'm sitting in a meeting and I hear somebody else talking, and somebody with recovery and somebody that's been through this, and they're talking about how they changed and then everything around them started to shift and how they started to grow, I think, wow, I want to do that. I want to try that. It didn't even occur to me that I was affected by this disease. I didn't know I had alcoholism in my life. And it wasn't like I was looking for it. It was just when I heard it, I recognized it. When you talked about it, I reckon that's what it was. I didn't know what it was. You know, I heard somebody say that their father was emotionally unavailable. I said, that's what it was. He wasn't necessarily, you know, abusive. He wasn't angry. He wasn't a rager. He was an authoritarian, but he was emotionally unavailable. So guess what I did when I went looking for people to date? That's exactly what I went looking for. And guess what I found? A lot of emotionally unavailable people, because it was what was familiar to me, but I didn't even know what it was. So I go back to the steps and I do those inventories, and I do the fear inventory and the sex and harms inventory. Sex and harms inventory is a great inventory. I know that people get, you know, hung up on the word sex, and it's not about, you know, the act of sex as much as it is sexuality, how I was taught about it, how I use it, how I feel about it, how it's, you know, related me to other people. And the harms inventory is one of the best inventories, because it's sort of the one that catches all the things that falls between the cracks and the fears and the resentments in inventory. The harms inventory is about, you know, the gossip and the criticism and the judgment, you know, all of these things that I go through life doing, the sarcasm. You know, I heard about sarcasm. I was really good. It was like an art form in my family. You know, Irish Catholics are really good at it, until I heard somebody say that the Latin root word of sarcasm means tearing of the flesh. And so now, once I know, I'm responsible. And that's the thing, is that once I hear you say it, I can't pretend like I don't know anymore. And so when I hear it, now it's like something that I have to work on, because if I'm saying that I'm coming here and I want to keep getting better and I keep asking God to reveal more to me, what do I do with it when he reveals it to me? If I just put it aside and say, oh, yeah, I do that, and then keep doing it, you know, that's not going to get me where I want to go, which is growing. So the point of doing the work and the point of doing the steps and the point of, you know, keep coming back is because I'm trying to come into a deeper relationship with a power greater than myself that I don't understand, but I know is there. And I'm trying to become more obedient to that higher power. I'm trying to hear that voice clearer, so that when it says it's time to go, I know that's not my idea, because my idea is to be comfortable. I like to be comfortable. God doesn't care so much about my comfort as much as he cares about my spiritual growth. So there's a lot of things that I am asked to do that are not comfortable, and they're not easy. But I am interested, because I know where this leads, this relationship with a power greater than myself, the kind of faith that I see in other people that I want, that dependence on God. I have that fully reliant on God, the frog, you know, the little F-R-O-G, fully reliant on God, or full reliance on God. And that's what I want, because when I find out what God's will in my life is, and every once in a while I realize that, oh, that's what he asked me to do, and I did it, and it worked out, and it was way better than anything I could have ever imagined. I also, just like the alcoholic, have that disease of more. I just want more of that. That felt good. I like that. It was a hard path to get there, but I like the result. This is not easy. This stuff is not easy. I always tell people Al-Anon is like the master's program of the 12 steps. You know, if you think stopping drinking was tough, you come in here and you start doing this work, this is difficult. And people say, well, you know, you shouldn't talk about how hard it is and all the work and everything. No, because the only thing that's more work than this or harder than this is to continue living the way I was living before I knew about the 12 steps, before I knew about recovery, before I knew about a higher power and reliance on a higher power. And so these steps are all designed, that big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the literature here is all designed to bring me into a relationship with a power greater than myself that can restore me to sanity. And the insanity of thinking that I know better, I know better for me. I know better for you. I don't know better. And the longer I'm here, the less I know, which is exciting to me because then there's more to learn. You know, there's always something new. It just irks me when a newcomer comes in and has like this great insight that I think, I remember this young girl came in and she was talking. She goes, you know, worrying is like praying for something that you don't want. And I was like, what the? I've been here like 25 years and I worry all the time about everything. And now she said that and it just puts on a light bulb that makes me think about something different when I start to worry. Now I start thinking about, thinking about something different. So I get distracted, you know, from my primary spiritual aim, which used to be worrying. And now my primary spiritual aim is asking, what's God's will in my life? And so that's why I keep coming back, because it just keeps getting better. And then in that fifth step, I talk to somebody, I talk to myself, I admit in a mirror a lot of the times. The fifth step is really effective, you know, to yourself and to another person and to God. But speaking it into a mirror is pretty powerful, because for a long time, I didn't want to look in the mirror. I didn't want to look at myself. I didn't want to remember. I didn't want to think about what was going on with me. And so to be able to face yourself squarely, let alone facing other people, is a great gift of the 12 steps. And the fifth step, and having somebody that gives you the gift of time to just be able to listen. You know, and I tell people all the time, and so you're not going to tell me anything new. You're not going to surprise me. You know, you might, you know, interest me, like, oh, I didn't do that, or I didn't think of that. But for the most part, I've heard it all at this point. What's nice about that is that, you know, you don't have to worry about what you're going to say. First of all, it's super important. I always tell people when I start talking to them, I just want to let you know, this is confidential. This is not going any further. Even on a phone call, even the first time somebody called me for the first time, I just want to let you know, this is confidential. This is really important. One of the most important things. I was talking to somebody, might have been somebody here, talking about a sponsor that told somebody else that she sponsored, perhaps, about something that this sponsee said. And then it got back. We've all heard this story. And this is one of the most damaging things, and which is so important to have that confidentiality and the anonymity. You know, the girls that I sponsor, they all know each other. Well, they don't all, but a lot of them know each other, but they would never know that I even talk to them. You know, they know that I talk to them and they know, but they'll never know that I know. And they'll call me and they'll say, ooh, this happened. And, you know, she was in an accident. I go, ooh, really? I don't, it's really important to me that they know that what they say is safe with me, because where else do you really get that? So the fifth step, 1 through 5. Brings up all of these defects of character that I mine 1 through 5 for in step 6. And I see how my defects have affected my relationships with other people. This is not some little thing. These are really deep-seated effects that have hurt relationships, have hurt me. And so step 6 is that, you know, I'm getting ready. I realize that this is really something that I need to do something about. And now I'm going to ask God in step 7 to remove these defects. And it's spiritual surgery. I don't do it myself. I don't get away from them. I don't leave them behind. I ask God to remove them. And the funny thing about having God remove them is that he doesn't remove them and that's it. They're gone. Just like I said about step 3, it's not something one and done. You know, I always say that those defects of character, you know, God might remove them and the way God sees fit, not the way I see fit. Because I think sometimes some of my defects are a good example of, you know, what not to do for other people. don't do that. But the defects, you know, sometimes I think they kind of change clothes and go to the back of the line and show up in all new and exciting ways. You know, I'm back. I don't even really recognize them, but there they are. And so this is a continuous thing. This is not like I'm done and I'm finished and I did the steps and that's it. The excitement of going through the steps, you know, they're just tools. And every time I reach that level and did them, and then I get to go back and do them again, or I get to do the traditions, or I get to do the concepts. And so step 6 and 7, which I really think are the meat and potatoes of this thing, you know, that's really what we're doing, is we're getting rid of those defects of character and we're clearing the way so that God can use us. And step 8, you know, talk about the people that we have harmed. And step 9, making amends with the help of a sponsor. And step 10, paying attention. Those defects are out there lurking around. Step 11, prayer and meditation. You know, I heard somebody say it's not an 11 and a half step program. It's a 12 step program. It's prayer and meditation. I always say prayer without meditation is like, praying without meditating is like ringing God's doorbell and then running away. I always tell the girls, I work with a lot of younger girls. So I was like, give him time. He's old. It takes me a while to get out of the chair to get to the door. Just give him some time. Sit quietly for a minute and let him get back to you and wait for him. You know, don't make him wait for you. And so step 11 and 12 is now I have a message to carry. And that's the point. That's why you're here today. So we have a message to carry. So when we have an opportunity for this gift of recovery, this is a great gift and it comes with a great responsibility. And the responsibility is to pass the message, but the message has to be clear. And the only way it's clear is by working those steps, 1 through 11, and then I get to 12. Now I'm going to take this message out there and I'm going to let people know that this is available, that no matter what is ailing you, no matter what is ailing you, that these 12 steps can have a profound effect on your life. But we in here are uniquely qualified to carry this message to families of alcoholics, because this is such a devastating, life-threatening disease that nobody wants to talk about. And if you don't know about Al-Anon, which is what the public outreach is so important for, if you have no idea it was there, I had no idea it was there. And I was profoundly affected by alcoholism and I had no idea until I met someone who was in recovery, you know, and got into Al-Anon. And so how do you find out about it? There are some great examples here and we've done it, you know, so I actually had volunteered to do outreach, public outreach in my group that I have gotten home group here now that I've been in Richmond. But I realized like, I still can't do it. I'm still not settled down enough to be able to make that kind of a commitment. And I had to go back and make amends and say, I can't do it. You know, I'm not the organizational type like that anyway. I'm not a business minded person anyway, but I do love to go out and I do love to speak to the college campuses, to the high school classes, to the, you know, to the public in general. I can talk about this thing until, you know, all day long. But organizing it, not so much, because I'm not that organized myself in the sense of I'm always on the road. I just got back again on Friday. And so I realized I bit off more than I could chew, but we're putting together a committee and we are working towards doing some of the things. And I heard some of those great things that you were talking about, you know, about public outreach. And that's why we get together, so that we can share those ideas. And so in step 12, the magnificent reality of these steps and why do we do what we do? I have to go through those steps on a personal level so that I have a message to pass. Now I have this great responsibility to pass this message, but it has to be a clear message. I don't want to go out there and do more damage. A lot of people, they, you know, Al-Anon, it's tough. You know, you go to these meetings and you hear people. I asked somebody the other day, I was at a meeting and there was a lot of reading. There was a lot of reading and they were just flipping through and it was just like a small book, but they were just flipping through and going next. And I said to somebody that was in that group, I said, why do they read so much? You know, nobody has a chance to talk. And they said, because there's a lot of people in there. Some of them are new, but there's a lot of people that come to Al-Anon that don't do the steps. And so they don't have a clear message. So year after year, they're sitting there and they're talking about the same thing and they're still talking about the problem. And so instead of letting them talk that much about the problem, it's better to read a piece of literature to hear the solution than to let people just go on and on. You know, the steps are the solution. The steps are going to bring you up the ladder to a relationship with a power greater than yourself that will give you the information that you need on a personal level about where to take the message, how to take the message, who to speak to. And I never hesitate to talk to people about God. It might take you a couple of seconds, but eventually you're going to know we're going to be talking about God. I might not say the word God, but it's really clear. I let people know. And I'll say to them when I first meet them and we'll be talking and they'll say, well, how'd you get to Richmond? And I'll say, well, you know, are you familiar with 12-step programs? And they'll say yes or no. In that answer, there's a lot of information. And if they say yes, I wonder what that means. And then I'll say, well, I've been, you know, a member of Al-Anon for a while and I go to meetings everywhere I go. And so I get to meet people and then I have the opportunity to talk to people and never pass up a chance to talk about it. You know, the secrets that I kept around alcoholism. And then why would I want to keep this a secret? You know, And if I find out that somebody is struggling with alcoholism and then they find out that I've been in Al-Anon, but I never said anything, that's like saying, oh, I saw this great movie. And they go, oh, I saw this great movie. Yeah, I saw that movie too. It was great. And I said, well, why don't you tell me about it? Oh, this restaurant, it's great. Yeah, I just went there the first time. I've been here for years. You never mentioned that restaurant, you know? We'll talk to people about other things, but we won't talk about this. It's like, this is my life today. You know, a friend of mine said, you know, oh, I went to AA to get a life. It seems like, you know, the 12-step programs are your life. And I said, yeah, you're right. You're right. There's nothing more important to me. Why am I here? What's my purpose? My purpose here today is to love and serve God. And how do I do that? By loving and serving people. By not being afraid to talk about what has had the most impact in my entire life. And for the past 40 years has been the most important thing that I've ever done. Now, there's different phases in that 40 years, you know, when I had my son, when I was working, you know, when I was living in different places, it was hard to do things and get places. But there's all these phases in your recovery of how much can you do? And the people that like are here that are able to do this kind of service, not everybody can do that at this point. But at some point, there's something that you can do in your group, you know, putting up the chairs. You know, when I first came in, it was the ABCs. It was ashtrays, brooms, and coffee cups, you know. So everybody had something. You had to tell me, I don't know what time. Okay. So everybody had something. And it's the little things, you know, it's the people that have the key that open the door. Everybody has a part in it. But a lot of people just want to come in and they just want the meeting to be there and they come in and they can dump or talk or read something and they leave and they feel better. You have a sponsor? Well, no. You know, have you started the steps? Well, no. All right. What are we doing here? What are we doing here? You know, it's not, I got nothing better to do on a Friday night, so I'm going to a meeting. You know, I feel a little bit better, or I go and I'm going to bitch and moan about, you know, him and tell you all the things that he did. You know, there is a solution here. And it is a beautiful program of recovery. There's so much here that it offers, but it also demands of us to give it away if we want to keep it. You know, I want to give it away, but I want to give it away with that clear message that comes from work in the steps, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. How do I have a spiritual awakening? How did I know that I was asleep in the first place? Because I get to that 12th step and I realize, wow, look what I just did. Look what just happened. You know, nobody can really say exactly what that is, but you know it. You know something's happening, you know, and that fifth step, oh, I love those phone calls after a fifth step the next day. Oh my God, I feel so fill in the blanks. Usually it has something to do with light, or I can breathe deeply again. It's such a blessing to be able to do this work with someone else. Such a blessing. And people say, well, I don't want to call you. I know you're so busy. No, you don't. Because if you knew me, you'd know I'm not that busy. I might sound busy, but I'm never too busy to talk about recovery. There is nothing more important to me. And I say, anything that I put in front of my recovery, I'm going to lose anyway. So recovery is always going to come first. And if I can't talk right now, I'll call you back. You know, just be sure that one of the things that I've learned here is how to take care of myself. And my sponsor says this all the time, and it really sounded like Greek to me. And she'll say to me, God first, you second, everybody else third. And I thought, what? What? No way. I mean, you know, I was raised with that. Don't be selfish. Well, this is a self-caring program, not a selfish program. And I need to learn how to take care of myself so that I do have something worthy to offer somebody else. And if I don't take care of myself first, put that oxygen mask on myself first, I have nothing else to give anybody else. And so I do need to take the time to do this for myself. And I do need to take the time to go to a meeting. And I do need the time to work with others. And I do need the time to take to do service. But then I ask myself, what could possibly be more important? You know, I have a birthday coming up Wednesday. We are Libras. We are very, I don't know about you, but woo. I have another birthday coming up and time is getting shorter. There's not that much time left to do this work. You know, it's the most exciting thing that I could possibly think of. It's the most important thing. So people will say, well, you know, do you want to go see this movie or read this book or something? I was like, this is not for everybody, you know, but to me, my focus, my time well spent is with, I'm not interested in socializing a lot, but I love the one-on-ones. Let's go have coffee, giving a newcomer a phone call and saying, hey, you want to get together? You know, the service work that you can do one-on-one. I don't do so well in big groups anymore, you know, socializing. I really like the connection, and I get the connection with one-on-one, a couple of people. And so there's nothing more fulfilling. Like, what do you want to talk about? The weather, sports, recipes. I love to eat. I love to cook. but I'm not interested in talking about it. If you want to talk about recovery, if you want to talk about God, you know, I think that this all boils down to one question that my higher power has for me. It's four words, and there is a one word answer. And the question that my higher power asks me is, do you trust me? And it's a yes or no answer. And if I say yes, then how I act in that yes is up to me. That's my choice. I can say, yes, I trust you, but, you know, everything after but is baloney. I trust you. Yes, I do. So how do I act in that? Please help me. Help strengthen my faith. I'm making a decision to trust you. And I'm going to probably take it back, but I'm going to give it back to you. I mean, I remember doing that third step like 400 times a day. It was like a tennis match. Give it to God, take it back, give it to God, take it back, give it to God, take it back. But I had something different than just taking it back and holding on to it. I had the opportunity, oh yeah, give it back. I had the opportunity to do step three. I had you guys in my head saying, do something different. So if I say, yes, I trust you, a lot of the times I think when God says, you know, what's the matter? Don't you trust me? And he's sort of like poking me in the arm, going, what's the matter? Don't you trust me? Like kind of kidding around, you know? But I had given him permission to say that when the stuff hits the fan and it's serious, I give you permission, you know, cut to the quick, don't play games. And so when I got a phone call from my sister-in-law saying my brother had a heart attack and that it was really dire, I heard this voice that I hear a lot right over my shoulder. And it was, do you trust me? Yes or no? That's it. Not yes, if I can see him. Yes, please don't take him. Yes, if his kids get to see him. It's either yes or no. Yes, I trust you. I would like to register a complaint. I do not like this one bit. This is scary. I don't like it. It's one of my greatest fears is to lose a sibling. But yes, I trust you. And then I will tell you that the ability to relax in that yes is phenomenal. And it's something that takes a lot of work and a lot of practice for me. But the ability to relax, it's not like I don't care. I care a lot. But I trust you. You have this. It's your call. It's not mine. My son, who's 32, is estranged. And I think, I have really, honest to God, you guys, no idea. I don't know if he's drinking. I don't know if he's doing drugs. I don't know anything. He comes and he goes. He comes and he goes. I have no idea what's going on. And thank God for my sponsor. Thank God for these slogans. I think Sue asked me, somebody asked me, what was my favorite slogan? And it's not really a slogan, but it's one of the things that I love the most. It says, is your horse in this race? And I want to argue about that. You know, Walt, it's my son. And my sponsor's like, is your horse in this race? It is not my horse and it is not my race. I am absolutely affected by it because I'm here in the grandstands and I got money on this horse, you know, and I want this horse to win, but I'm not going to be able to do anything except stand by and watch. And in the watching, in the trusting, in the yes, God of it, I get to rely on my faith, I get to rely on my experience, I get to rely on my program, I get to rely on the fellowship, I get to rely on all of the things that I've learned here because it's experiential. And it is a repeatable experience. There's nothing new under the sun when it comes to alcoholism. So the stories are different, you know, the details are different, but the stories are always the same. And so we are, as I said before, uniquely qualified to help people. And people say, oh, you could do this and you could do that and you could go here and you could go there. I could do a lot of things. But the most important thing that I could ever possibly do is to be able to bring this message. And, you know, in the 12-step programs, it's not like you don't have to drink again or you don't have to control an alcoholic or you don't have to get crazy about. The message to me is that there is a God that loves you and wants what's best for you. That's the message of the 12 steps, is that there's a God, there's a higher power that loves you, that is love, that wants what's best for you. Even if you don't agree that that's what's best for you, but just try it and then wait and see. And in your experience, you can look back and say, wow, that worked out better than I ever could have imagined. I had no idea about the gifts that were in that pain and in that discomfort. And as I said before, I don't think my higher power really cares if I'm comfortable or not. He just wants to know, are you willing? Are you willing to do what I'm asking you to do? Because my interest, my higher power says, is in your spiritual growth, which now, after being here for a while, is much more interesting to me than my comfort. And honestly, I don't care if I'm happy. I don't care if I have the guy or the car or the money or the job. I spent years, decades worrying about that stuff, being self-employed, being a self-employed artist for 48 years. You could bet I worried about money and I worried about work and I worried about a lot of things. But today, there's nothing that I would rather do than God's will, because I have seen that God's will is the best thing that I could possibly do, because it's designed specifically by my creator for me. I have a purpose here, and I don't have to know it for tomorrow. I just have to know it for right here, right now. And if I could keep my head where my feet are, I'm always okay. I could be a little shaky, but I'm always okay. It's when I step into the past or into the future that I get into trouble. And I tell this story that I saw one of those little, God help me, those stupid shorts on YouTube that are so addicting, you know, little short films. But there was one where a woman is standing at the bottom of the stairs and she's filming. The top of the stairs is like a white lab sitting with his back on the top step, sitting on the top step there with his back to you. And you know what zoomies are with the dogs when they just get crazy and they start running around like maniacs? And there's a little black dog and all you can see is the top of the stairwell. And you see the little black dog running this way and this way and this way and that way. And the white lab is sitting there and he's just going like this and he's looking back like this. And he's just watching this dog. The dog is manic and he's running back and forth like crazy. And I'm looking at that and I'm thinking, oh, that white lab is my higher power. And that little maniac black dog is me. And I'm running into the past and I'm running into the future. And God's just sitting there going, whenever you're done, you could just come right back here, right here, right now, and sit here with me and be at home and rest in my love. Because God doesn't know anything but love. God is love. You know, and love is, as Dr. Bob says, it's also in that other big, big book that I read. The definition of love is, you know, wishing God's will for somebody. And I said, I could do that, even to the people that I have a really hard time with. And I can also hope that God's will is that you go out and twist your ankle or stub your toe. But again, kind of like as my horse in this race, I don't really have any, you know, thing to do with that, but I can wish it, you know, and I can hope that that horse does well. So I am so grateful that my sponsor has helped me with this. Biggest of issues that I've had is the letting go of my son. And I can tell you that I am at peace with it, although it doesn't make any sense to me. And I tell her all the time, and I was telling somebody the other day, and I said, there's so few people in my life that I can talk to about this because, as she says, they don't have an Al-Anon program. They're not doing what we're doing here, which is letting go and trusting God. And I've let go to the point of, this is not my son. This is God's son. And I remember saying to him a couple of years ago, like, I need him to call me. It was Mother's Day. I was in San Francisco. I think, I need him to call me. God, I need him to call me. I need him to call me. And I stopped mid-sentence and I thought, wait a minute. I don't need anything from him. I don't need anything from him. I would love for him to call me. I would love to see him. I would love to hear from him. But I don't need anything except you, God. I need you. And if I have you, then everything else will take care of itself. And I can tell you so oddly that I am at peace. I know where my son is. I have a general idea, but he's not in touch with anybody. And I'm okay letting go. My sister-in-law wants to storm the castle. But I say, and then I say to my sponsor, I don't know what to tell my family. I went to a wedding and he didn't go. And what do I tell my family when they say, whoa, where's John? What's he doing? And she said, just tell him he's doing his own thing. I don't have to explain or defend anything. Not my horse, not my race. And so it doesn't make any sense. A lot of this stuff doesn't make any sense, especially to people out there that aren't doing this work. But the fact is that there's this peace that passes understanding that comes with doing this work and trusting in a power greater than myself, restoring me to sanity. My experience is my past. My strength is my present. And my hope is the future. And I continue to hope that things just keep getting better. And I can tell you that after coming back year after year, 40 years later, they just melt away. There's just one big, long journey, just like anything else. I am grateful today for alcoholism in my life. I am grateful to have been affected by this family disease, because if I weren't, I would never have found the rooms of Al-Anon. And I would never have found you guys, and I would never have found this way of life, and I certainly would not have found this relationship that I have with a power greater than myself that has restored me, some would argue, to sanity. I don't know if it restored me to sanity, which, you know, presumes that I had it in the first place. I don't know about that. But I have a life that is beyond my wildest dreams. And that's not about the car and the guy and the house and everything. It's my wildest dreams are, I never had, had no idea that this was available, that this spiritual life was available to me. And people say, oh, it's the spiritual part of the program. No, no, everything is spiritual. God is everywhere. There's no picking apart what's spiritual and what's not. It's all spiritual and it's all God. And if it's all God, it's all good because God is love. And the message of Al-Anon and Alcoholics Anonymous and Alateen is love. And that's the language that we speak here. So thank you from my heart.
Thank you.